both counsel or all counsel. The next case of the morning is United States versus Angel Lechuga.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Hold on just a second. Let everybody get settled and cleared out. Okay, Mr. Obeyer.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Kirk Obeyer. I represent the appellant, Angel Lechuga Ponce, pursuant to an appointment under the Criminal Justice Act. Your Honor, I think this is perhaps a unique scenario I find myself in because all but one page of my brief have now been obviated by the Booker decision, which came out four business days ago. And now I find myself arguing points that have nothing to do with what I've raised on appeal. That being my most colorful introduction I could come up with, I'd like to
Enlighten us on Booker then.
now it's all about Booker. That's
right. Which you may have to do. I don't know. We'll see.
Well, I had the opportunity, and I hope the court has had the opportunity, to review Booker in enough detail to be able to address the issues that I think are raised by this appeal. And essentially, there are two opinions of the court in the United States Supreme Court opinion, United States versus Booker. The first concurring opinion deals with the Sixth Amendment issue, the application of Blakely, and this court's finding of in Booker at the Seventh Circuit level that the United States sentencing guidelines are violative, at least with regard to how Blakely applies to the Sixth Amendment portion of the problem. The second concurring opinion in the United States Supreme Court case issued last week deals with the remedial where we go from here component of now that Blakely does apply to the United States sentencing guidelines. So clearly there's two components of any case now where United States sentencing guidelines have been applied, and it's specifically mentioned in
the problem here really that none of these cases, Prendi or any of these cases, ever cast any doubt on the ability of the judge to assess prior criminal conduct.
That's correct, Judge Evans. The question, I think, now given the, what I think is a step forward in the law or a step away from what the law had previously been in the remedial portion of the opinion in Booker, is that the guidelines cannot be regarded as mandatory at the sentencing level, and that the portion of the Sentencing Reform Act that treated the guidelines as mandatory and essentially remove discretion from the sentencing judge, as well as that portion of the Sentencing Reform Act that recently was added pursuant to the PROTECT Act that would call for a court of appeals to apply a de novo standard to application of the guidelines. Essentially, what has occurred is that, and this case is a good example of one where the judge contemplated very specifically whether or not he had to follow the guidelines. And in fact, the record does demonstrate various points where the judge is pronouncing sentence where he struggled with various issues and was attempting to find room for a departure, but basically came to the conclusion that, particularly with regard to the 16-level enhancement that applied in Mr. Lechuga's case because he had previously been deported pursuant to a conviction or subsequent to a conviction for an aggravated felony. Examples in the record that demonstrate the judge, you know, did have concern with regard to the fact that this was being treated in a mandatory manner and given the state of the law at the time.
Why does any of this include criminal history? That's an exception to the...
Judge Cudahy, the question, as I understand it, is do we still look at the language in Apprendi, the language in Ring, and the language in Blakely that discusses the fact that with the exception of prior criminal history, factors must be considered by a jury, or that right to a jury must be waived. There cannot be a preponderance of the evidence standard. That's why I direct the court to, really, that's just the first portion of the Booker analysis, because the second portion, the remedial portion of the Booker analysis, applies to all cases where there are sentencing guidelines being applied. And really, the rationale behind that is that in the course of discussing this, the opinion points out that it's not simply a matter of whether a Sixth Amendment right exists per se in any given case. It's part of trial negotiations, part of trial strategies, it's part of charging decisions, it's part of how agreements are reached, and it's much more involved in the process. It's really pointed out in dicta along the way to coming to the conclusion in analyzing whether or not the Sentence Reform Act can be severed, portions of it can be severed and portions of it remain intact. And essentially the conclusion, the bottom line, with regard to any case that's before any sentencing court in the United States District Courts, is that the guidelines must be regarded as discretionary, providing guidance, wisdom, knowledge gathered by the United States Sentencing Commission and so forth, but are not to be treated as mandatory. And we know in this case that they were.
I don't know that there's anything you can read in any of these cases that goes to the criminal history category point system used in the guidelines.
I think you're right, Judge Evans. The problem here is that this is not a traditional criminal history category enhancement. In fact, in this case, on an entirely separate issue, the judge did exercise his discretion where he felt appropriate and reduced the criminal history category itself. We're talking about an element of the offense that under, I'm sure the court's aware of the Almendarez-Torres doctrine, is treated as an element of the offense and is essentially regarded sort of like criminal history because of the fact that it is a component of the offense itself.
Well, the 16-level increase, was it? What was that? Was that on the basis of a violent, a crime of violence?
In this particular case, Judge Mannion, the enhancement was based upon the fact that Mr. Lechuga had previously been convicted of an aggravated assault, which the real facts of that case, which was addressed by the sentencing court in this case, was that he was impaired operating a motor vehicle, and when there were attempts to stop him, he didn't stop immediately, and there was an officer in the way of the vehicle and so on, and it was basically charged as, and he ended up pleading to an aggravated assault in that case. That's the only element of violence that was there, but under the very broad definition under the United States Sentencing Guidelines as to what constitutes an aggravated felony, it does qualify. And the court in this case, in the sentencing court in this case, did struggle with that concept, but you know, basically conceded that it had to be done that way.
Well, the reason is this Leo Cal case. Are you familiar with that versus Ashcroft?
No.
It's a Supreme Court case, and we dug it up. This person was convicted for driving under the influence of alcohol and causing serious bodily injury in the accident in violation of Florida law. Was not a crime of violence and thus was not an aggravated felony warning deportation under the Immigration and Naturalization Act.
I'm familiar with the concept that the court is addressing.
Well, it would, if this were the case here, it would mean that maybe there would be a resentencing and there would be something other than 16 increase. That doesn't mean he stays here, ultimately, does it?
Right, that's correct.
And whenever he gets out of prison, he's out of here, right?
That's correct, Judge.
So it's
that's
a question of how long he's going to stay in prison.
How long he stays in the United States serving a sentence before being deported.
And I'm just wondering if this case has some bearing on this.
I think what happened in this case is that technically...
This case, the one I'm just looking at, you may not be familiar with Leo Cal.
I'm familiar with the concept, Your Honor. But essentially, as I recall, there was an issue with regard to it was charged as an aggravated assault.
So you're saying that the charge here is what you're stuck with, regardless of what the facts of the underlying offense?
That is my understanding. That was the court's conclusion as well.
Okay, so this wouldn't make any difference then.
It's not my impression that it would.
Okay, well, I just want to make sure we considered that because it does have some bearing, at least in similarity, if not in charge.
However, I would state that it may have an impact with regard to the manner in which the sentencing court had perceived its ability to exercise discretion. And the reason I say that is because when we look to the record, the court acknowledged that this was very hedgy in terms of whether it was, in fact, an aggravated felony, and that the rationale behind imposing a 16-level enhancement with regard to discouraging recidivism and with regard to discouraging reentry into the country, bear in mind, Your Honors, this was an individual who has 6 children born in this country. I see that my time is up.
Well, you got a minute left if you want to reserve it.
I would like to reserve it, Your Honor.
Okay, follow up on that.
Got a pretty good argument when you started off by telling us only had a page left. Very good job.
Mr. Giampietro.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court and Counsel, my name is Gordon Giampietro. I represent the appellee, United States of America, in this case. Of the four issues identified in the defendant's brief, we've already indicated that three of the four, I think, are mooted by the Booker decision of last week. The fourth issue, which related to the district court's decision not to give the defendant credit for time served under 18 U.S.C. 3585, is responded to in the government's brief, and I hope that it's adequately responded to in the brief, so I won't go into that argument today.
With respect to that, you seem to concede that the time he spent in the state prison could have been the subject of a departure, but the rest of it was up to the Bureau of Prisons. Is that that's your position?
That's the position of the government, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Suppose there's nothing, according, he didn't file a request for departure, so that leaves that part of it in doubt. But under current circumstances, could the Bureau of Prisons address both of these periods or just one while he's in federal custody?
I believe that under 3585B, the Bureau of Prisons is only empowered to look from the period when the federal sentence commences. So I don't think the Bureau of Prisons could go back
and
account for that
time. So the state time will fall through the crack under that analysis.
That's certainly the position of the government, Your Honor. So I won't discuss, as counsel did not, the issues in the brief, except to say that the fourth issue, again, as we've just talked about, Your Honor, I'll rest on the government's brief in that regard. What I do want to discuss this morning is where we go from here in light of Booker and Fanfan, specifically the question of the appropriate standard of review in a case like this. But before I get into that discussion, Judge Mannion, I wanted to respond to your question about the nature of the aggravated felony. In the pre-sentence report at paragraphs 38 and 39, that sets forth the facts that relate to that particular conviction. The aggravated assault is more than simply a driving while intoxicated. That was part of the offense, but he actually struck a police officer in conjunction with the arrest. So I don't think there would be leeway to argue that that aggravated felony wouldn't qualify.
It was an intentional act.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Wouldn't qualify under the guidelines. With respect to the appropriate standard of review in this case, I think there are probably two choices for the court. One is harmless error and one is plain error. And the choice between those two is going to depend on to what extent the court feels the defendant preserved a Blakely argument in the district court. I won't belabor the point, but as the court knows in footnote 3 of the government's brief at page 15, we suggested that possibly the defendant waived Blakely here by making a decision not to assert it, because he expressed some concern that he wouldn't get acceptance of responsibility if he challenged a 16-point enhancement. Having said that, if the court is satisfied that that was sufficient reservation or preservation, I should say, of the Booker argument, the harmless error review in that case, and I would argue this is a non-constitutional error, because, of course, we know from the Apprendi line of cases that Booker preserved, prior convictions are not something that raised Sixth Amendment concerns. So I think if he has preserved a Booker argument, we're in the world of harmless error. And as this court knows, the proper standard then is whether the error had a substantial and injurious effect or influence in the determination of the sentence. If we are, however, in plain error world, the court is familiar with the four elements of that test. And I don't think the government certainly doesn't think that with respect to considerations 3 and 4, the defendant can satisfy his burden under plain error. For sake of argument, the government would concede this question of whether the guidelines are mandatory or advisory could be considered error. It could be considered plain error. But whether that affected substantial rights and further whether this court should take notice of it is something the government would take issue with. from the government's perspective, this guideline sentence of 70 months, which was obviously the bottom of the applicable guideline range, is a reasonable sentence under Booker and is not something that this court should reverse under harmless error or plain error standards. The crux of the matter is whether the district court really would have given a different sentence if he had known that the guidelines were advisory rather than mandatory. And I think if you look at this record here and you look specifically at the sentencing transcript, it's very difficult to conclude one way or the other. And under these circumstances, I will put forth a few arguments as to why I think the judge would not have. Specifically, the judge entertained at least two, I think maybe three different downward departure motions. One related to an overstatement of criminal history. The defendant requested rather than be in Category 6, the court considered him to be in Category 4. The judge chose Category 5. And in the process of thinking about that, the judge commented that he thinks, potentially, the defendant's criminal history could be understated in this case. If you recall, the defendant had 18 points, if they were all counted, based on these prior convictions. And so the judge's comments that one could say that this criminal history was understated suggests, I think, that it's not likely his decision would be different, the sentence would be different, if he were faced with an advisory guideline scheme. And I think also with respect to this question of whether the defendant was likely to commit new offenses, the judge commented that he was willing to reduce this by one criminal history category because he felt that the severe sentence he was going to receive, the 70 months, would convince him not to return. And so the court was satisfied that he could reduce the criminal history category by one level because this time the defendant would not come back, whereas in the past he had come back at least on two different occasions after being deported. So admittedly, this is a difficult question to look at this transcript and determine whether the judge would or would not have given a different sentence. But from the government's perspective, if this court is going to have to draw a bright line here in terms of which of these cases under harmless error review go back for resentencing and which do not, this is a case, I think, where even under harmless error review, the 70-month sentence should be affirmed. If there are any further questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Okay. I don't know what we're going to do on some of these cases about supplemental briefing and that sort of thing. I think, though, we'll wait when we get kind of a court decision on how to proceed on some of these. So,
well, thank you, Your Honor, for that. For those reasons, the government requests that the 70-month sentence be affirmed.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Robert.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to dovetail the court's comment there, and just given the unusual timing of this case, I would request the court permit supplemental briefing.
Yeah, we may request it. I do want to wait because there's some things going on internally here about what we're going to, how we're going to proceed with lots and lots of cases.
This court, and I believe, Your Honor, last time I was here, commented that the world turns on standards of review, or at least this world does. And Booker really doesn't give us much help because it appears to be sort of dicta at the end of the second concurring opinion that there are all sorts of different standards of review that might apply here, and really it seems to be an effort to assuage the dissenters that it's really not as bad as it seems in terms of the problems that have been created by this opinion. But I do want to point out several aspects of the record here, and one comment. I've discussed this with Mr. Giampietro, and essentially we both agree that it may be appropriate just to comment on the status of how cases like this have been handled by this and other judges subsequent to Blakely. This court, as well as other sentencing courts in the United States District Courts, have been giving sort of dual sentences. And this case happened at a time when the court had not yet established that policy, but within a couple of weeks after this. And again, the timing was such that Blakely came down, then we had this case, then the court adjusted its policy. Really, he's held in the lurch here because we really don't know. What we do know is that in other cases, this court and others have given dual sentences, one if Booker turns out that the guidelines are mandatory, one if Booker turns out that they are discretionary, and in cases similar to this, this court has given sentences, if the guidelines are discretionary, in unlawful reentry cases, the sentences have invariably been lesser. Now, I just say that not for substantive points, and it's not part of the record, but I do believe that that's important with regard to the timing here and why there would be evidence on the record with regard to why the court felt that there was probably reasons to go downward from where he was. I'd also point out, may I have one more point here?
Okay, wrap it up.
Yes, sir. The court, in addressing the Blakely was raised, it was briefed, it was discussed at great length whether or not Blakely called for the 16-level enhancement. The court came to the conclusion that it must apply the 16-level enhancement and use the term mandatory in its determination that he would have to apply the 16-level enhancement. The other factors that Mr. Giampietro raised, the other factors that are part of the sentencing scheme, there were different factors involved in terms of why the court made those adjustments, and they were raised in different ways. But really, I think it's clear here, the court issued a sentence based upon the court's impression that he had to follow the sentencing guidelines, specifically the 16-level enhancement. And I think the record is abundant that he probably would not have had he been able to regard the sentencing scheme as advisory only.
Okay, thank you. This case will be taken under advisement. I understand you are court appointed.
Yes, Your Honor.
Appreciate your taking the assignment and doing good work for your client.
You're welcome.
Thank you.